Dear colleagues, dear students, dear friends, welcome to you all. My name is Laurent Mignon, I'm a professor of Turkish literature and a fellow of St. Anthony's College. In our age ridden with wars, terror, and conflicts, an age when in Europe too, cultural and political polarization have reached new heights, literature seems to be one of the last spaces that enables peaceful encounters and respectful exchanges, and the very empathy that is the basis of any meaningful dialogue. So I'm really delightful today to welcome four actors that make this very dialogue possible. First of all, Jean Dost, the award-winning Kurdish-Syrian novelist, poet, and translator, widely regarded as the leading voice in Kurdish literature, who with great elegance moves between Arabic and Kurdish. He is the author of four poetry collections and not less than 16 novels in Kurdish and Arabic, some of which have been translated into English, Farsi, Italian, Spanish, and last but not least, Turkish. And he himself has also translated a number of books into Arabic and Kurdish, and very importantly, from Kurdish into Arabic, like the great love epic Mem Uzin. Now, Marilyn Booth, whom I do not really need to introduce here, so welcome home. Marilyn Booth is Professor Emerita of Arabic and Islamic Studies at the Faculty of Asian and Middle Eastern Studies and Magdalen College. She's one of the foremost translators, as you know, of modern Arabic literature. She translated Celestial Bodies from Arabic, which won the International Booker Prize in 2019. Her English translation of Jean Dost's Safe Corridor received the inaugural Beit al-Rasham Dar Arab International Translation Prize. And I should stress here that Safe Corridor is already the 21st volume that you translated.
At least. Yeah, I think that's about right. Yeah.
So that's, well, great. Our third guest is Ali Al-Mujaini, who is executive manager of, of Dar Arab for Publishing and Translation, which is based in both Muscat, in Muscat and London. He also directs the Beit al-Rasham Dar Arab International Translation Prize, now in its third round, I believe. Then Nasser El-Badri, who is the founder and director of Dar Arab for Publishing and Translation, and a publishing house that works to expand the presence of Arabic literature in English and other world languages. Now, this evening we come together to present and discuss Jean Dost's novel Safe Corridor and his contributions to Arabic and Kurdish literatures. So I encourage you to have a look and even to buy Safe Corridor. I think there are a few copies here, both in English translation, but also in Arabic. And you will see it is a great novel about war, survival, and the power of imagination. A novel that I promise you will haunt you for a very long time. So, thank you. I will say a few words about the way we will proceed today, if I manage to find my notes. Here they are. I believe that first Ali and Nasser will briefly present Dar Arab's work and goals. After that, Jean will read a statement in Arabic that will be also translated into English by Marilyn. Then Marilyn and Jean will read excerpts from the novel in Arabic and in English. You will see these are different excerpts. So if you don't understand Arabic, don't be worried at all. Don't forget that Jean is a poet, so the language is music, so just let yourself be overflown. So, thank you, and Ali, I believe.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ali Mujaini, and I serve as the executive manager of Dar Arab and the coordinator of the Bayt al Ghasham Dar Arab International Translation Prize. It's a real pleasure to be around you here and to be also in Oxford, a place that is very related to the core of what we do at Dar Arab. I would like to say thank you to Laurent and to the center. And let me tell you the story of Dar Arab. Back in 2017, our founder, Nasser al-Badri, who is the former president of Omani Authors Association, had spent a couple of years in UK, living in the UK, and he was curious about the number, the readership of Arabic literature in English, and he started researching and looking in bookstores and doing like a field work and a research work. And he found out that only a few dozens, if not a single dozen, of globally, of Arabic literature is translated into English every year. And from that moment, from that discovery, the Arab seed was planted. The house started in 2017. And I think that, yeah, started in 2017, and then it spent 3 years of building a name, building a reputation to get the first book out back in 2020. Dar Arab is one of the very few houses in the UK that are specialized into translation from one certain language or from one certain culture. And the only one doing so from Arabic language. Our list already includes works from Oman, Kuwait, Syria, Jordan, Iraq, Egypt, Sudan, Morocco, and Mauritania, and it continues to grow. At Dar Arab, we definitely say at our email signatures that we are not a construction company, but yet we build bridges. And for us, translation is more than just carrying meaning from a language or to another. It's more about cultural generosity, listening, reimagining. And from that belief stem the prize that is called Bayt al-Ghasham Dar Arab International Translation Prize. It's a joint initiative between Dar Arab from London here and then a culture center in Muscat called Bayt al-Ghasham. The prize exclusively focuses on translation from Arabic into English, honoring, supporting, and celebrating translators who bring Arabic literature into new linguistic and cultural spaces. Also, it opens doors for new voices at Arabic language to be translated into English in one of its categories where it celebrates the unpublished Arabic works. Our first winning work represents that mission beautifully. Safe Corridor, written by Jan Doss, translated by Marilyn Booth, was like the first of the inaugural prize, inaugural year. And that was a collaboration that embodies the empathy, precision, and imagination we hope that the prize continues to inspire. The book was published last August, and it's been wonderful to see it travel from pages to conversations like these. Marilyn Booth not only continues her extraordinary work as a translator and scholar, but also now she serves as the head of Prize Board of Trustees, guiding our vision with experience, generosity, and care. She also serves as a professor emerita at this very college, which makes tonight especially meaningful for all of us. And there is another coincidence that we were talking to Eugene today morning about. here at Santa Anthony's, graduated the, like, we've worked with a translator, I think many of you know, called Roger Allen. We've worked with him for like around 6 works, and he's like the highest published translator with Dar Arab. Roger Allen was the first doctoral graduate from San Anthony's College in modern Arabic literature back in 1986 under Muhammad Mustafa Badawi. That was like, 1968, sorry, not 86, 68, so for us being here tonight is more than like, it doesn't feel just like an event that we are coming to do. It's more than, more of like, we are connected to this place, to the core of this place, values and mission. So I'm really proud that we are here tonight, and I'll leave the word to Marley and Jan and their host. Thank you for listening.
I would just add that when I was thinking about what Dar Arab might add, and looking at the like studies being done about translation from the Arab world to English or Western, I found that there is no real initiative to bring the real voices. All the effort that around 15 to maximum 20 translated books per year was supported by governments in the Arab world. And those governments, they want to show that they are generous and they are paying for translation. So they will bring the past to the you know, people, which is, I don't mind, but it's not reflecting what's going on in the Arab world. It's not reflecting the current literature. It's not reflecting what's going on in the society. It's not reflecting any politics, anything. It's like the current people is not exist to the Western world. Now, there is a fight, I believe in myself. There is a fight in thoughts, in imagination, and what we know about each other. What we see here in Britain, what we see in London, all these people going and coming, Palestine, Syria, here and there, Iraq, all this, how those people, those voices could be presented if there is no real initiatives. So I thought, you know what? Let's see if government aside, let's see if all this, you know, I was speaking with the professor, you know, sorry, I'm not good at names.
No,
and I told him, look, when the Arab world decide to do media in London, they came here with their millions to put, like, to podcast, like channels, TVs, whatever, you know, in Arabic. When they want to release a newspaper, they will release a newspaper in Arabic. They are running from their own places to you know, using, as he said, using the media, the free like media here, but they put it in Arabic. Now, we need to be heard. I'm a poet myself, you know. I need to be heard. I need to be heard by, like, you know, other, like, you know, the human that lives in this Western countries. So we need someone who is not linked to any of this, you know, political whatever institutions or whatever, and we bring our own voices to the people, to people, without any, you know, any whatever, you know. So yeah, that was behind our stuff about Professor Marlene being the head. This is what we do, the head of our prize. What we do after she won the first prize, then we I called her, say, you know what, this is what we do. Anyone who win, he need to become part of the, you know, of the prize. So we every year we change judges. We change, like, we try to change that. Well, not the trustees, but the judges. We need to change them every year. So the winner become a judge next year. That's what we do. And she was the winner. She became a judge next year. Then the third year, she became the head of trustees. So thank you, Marlene, for that support.
You're welcome. But if you ever submit to the prize, just keep that in mind.
So now, Jean Dost is going to read out his statement.
Good evening, everyone. My speech will be in Arabic because my English is not so very well. Good.
Better than mine, really.
No,
but that's okay.
I welcome you all and hope we have a great time together. And I will begin. اسمحوا لي أولا أن أشكر المنظمين والقائمين على هذا اللقاء حيث أتاحوا لي فرصة التحدث إليكم عن رواية ممر آمن التي تتحدث عن كل الحروب وليس فقط عن الحرب السورية. كما أشكر فريق دار عرب للترجمة والنشر وخاصة السيد ناصر البدري الذي بذل جهودا واضحة من أجل طبع الكتاب ونشره وإخراجه بالصورة التي يليق به. تترك الحروب ندوبا لا تمحى لا على الأرض فقط بل في أعماق الأرواح أيضا، وإذا كان الدمار المادي واضحا للعيان فإن الدمار النفسي أكثر خفاء لكنه أشد قسوة، والحرب بكل ما تحمله من عنف وخراب لا تميز بين ضحاياها، والأطفال بلا شك هم الفئة الأكثر هشاشة وتعرضا للأذى، فهم يدخلون عالم العنف دون أن يملكوا أي وسيلة لفهمه أو مقاربته أو مقاومته. في سوريا التي عاشت أكثر من عقد من الحرب تحولت الطفولة من مساحة للبراءة والخيال إلى ساحة للمأساة. قتل آلاف الأطفال وتحول مئات الآلاف إلى أيتام وشرد الملايين من منازلهم ومدارسهم. كثير من هؤلاء لم يعرفوا معنى الاستقرار يوما ولم يختبروا حياة طبيعية كالتي يعيشها أقرانهم في أماكن أخرى من العالم. الحرب كانت حاضرهم الوحيد وشكلت قاموسهم اليومي كلمات مثل قصف، نزوح، لجوء، مجزرة، وهذه الكلمات حلت محل لعبة ومدرسة وعيد. في هذه الرواية ولكوني أنتمي إلى الشعب الكردي الذي عانى من القهر في ظل النظام السابق أسلط الضوء على تفصيل صغير من تفاصيل الحرب المدمرة في المنطقة الكردية من سوريا. لقد شهدت تلك المنطقة أحداثا كبيرة وشهد العالم كله هناك هزيمة أسطورة داعش ثم التدخل العسكري التركي في عفرين وغيرها من المناطق مما لم يجذب اهتمام الإعلام العالمي كثيرا. تتحدث الرواية على وجه التحديد عن التدخل التركي في عفرين بالاعتماد على فصائل عسكرية مرتبطة بها. لا أتحدث عن تفاصيل المعارك ولا عن الدمار الذي لحق بالجسور والمباني، بل أتحدث عن الدمار الذي لحق بروح فتى مراهق وعائلته الصغيرة المنكوبة. إن الطفل الذي يكبر تحت وابل القنابل لا يشبه الطفل الذي يكبر تحت سقف آمن، فالأثر النفسي لا يزول بانتهاء القتال بل يرافق الإنسان طوال حياته من القلق المزمن إلى اضطراب ما بعد الصدمة ومن الكوابيس الليلية إلى صعوبات التواصل والانخراط بالمجتمع، ويصبح هذا الثقل النفسي أكثر وطأة حتى حين يغيب الدعم وتغيب الرعاية المتخصصة. في روايتي حاولت أن أفتح نافذة على هذا العالم المعتم الذي حاولت أن أروي الحكايات التي لا تجد مكانا في نشرات الأخبار، حكايات الأطفال الذين أصبحوا كبارا قبل أوانهم والذين صاغت الحرب شخصياتهم وخيالاتهم وغيرت مصائرهم. لم تكن الروايات توثيقا مباشرا بل كانت محاولة لفهم ما لا يفهم ولإعطاء صوت لمن لا صوت له. إنني على تماس مباشر مع أطفال حالتهم مشابهة تماما لحالة بطل قصة كاميران، وإن أفرادا من عائلتي نفسها يعانون ما عاناه البطل الطفل، ولهذا لم تكن هذه الرواية نتاج خيال بحت بل ثمرة معايشة حقيقية وشهادة على واقع موجع ما زال مستمرا. اليوم قد ترجم هذا العمل إلى اللغة الإنجليزية ونناقشه في فضاء أكاديمي كجامعة أكسفورد. أشعر بأهمية أن تنقل هذه القصص إلى العالم لا كصور عابرة بل كحكايات كاملة بكل ألمها وتعقيدها وإنسانيتها. ويطيب لي هنا أن أعبر عن امتنان العميق للمترجمة القديرة مارلين بوث التي لم تكتفي بالترجمة بل التقطت روح النص وعمقه الإنساني لتقدمه إلى قراء الإنجليزية بصورته الأصلية والمؤثرة. أتمنى أن يكون لترجمتها الحساسة والواعية دور جوهري في إيصال هذا العمل إلى جمهور أوسع وفي حفظ نبرته وصوته الداخلي. إن الحروب ليست مجرد صراع سياسي وعسكري، بل هي كوارث بشرية تضرب في العمق وتعيد تشكيل المجتمعات من جديد، بدءا من أضعف حلقاتها الأطفال. وأنا آمل أن تدفع روايتي القارئة للتأمل لا في سوريا وحدها، بل في كل مكان يعاني فيه الأطفال من ويلات الحروب، لأن مسؤوليتنا كمبدعين وكتاب ليست فقط في رواية ما حدث، بل في طرح السؤال الأهم: كيف يمكن أن نصنع عالما لا يضطر فيه الأطفال إلى فقدان طفولته؟
So I'll read my translation. You did add an extra little couple sentences at the end, so I don't, you know, but anyway, I'll try to. So, first, says Jean, let me offer my thanks to the organizers and sponsors of this gathering, giving me the opportunity to speak about my novel, Memor Amin Safe Corridor. And I also want to thank Dar Arab and the publishers of Dar Arab for their fantastic work. This novel addresses all wars, not only the war in Syria, which unfortunately has not ended. Wars leave scars that cannot be rubbed out or covered over. These are scars not only on the surfaces of visible reality, but also scars that rupture inner selves. If the material destruction is there before our eyes, the psychological devastation is hidden to our vision. Yet the damage done to human selves is the grimmer kind of destruction, the more merciless. War, that's better, war with all of its violence and the ruin it wreaks does not distinguish among its diverse victims. Yet there's no doubt that children are the most fragile victims, those most exposed to harm. They come into this world of violence without possessing any means to understand it, let alone resist it. In Syria, which has lived through more than a decade of war, childhood has been transformed. From being a space of innocence and imagination, it has become a place of flight, rescue, and survival. Thousands of children have been killed. Hundreds of thousands have been orphaned. Millions have been driven from their homes and schools and left without any place to go. Many of these children have never known what it means to be safe and secure. They have never experienced a normal, natural life like that enjoyed by children elsewhere in the world. War has been the only reality they have lived. War has shaped their daily vocabulary. Words like bombing, migration, refuge, asylum, massacre, these words now hold the place that playing, school, or holiday once held. In this novel, and because I belong to the Kurdish people who suffered harsh repression over the course of the previous regime's rule, I train a spotlight on one small element, one among the many, many features and scenes of the catastrophic war in Syria. The Kurdish region in Syria's north and northeast has witnessed up close some of the war's major events. The whole world saw the legendary defeat of Daesh there. Soon thereafter, there was the Turkish military intervention in Afrin and other Kurdish areas, but these did not attract much attention from the world's news media. This novel then focuses specifically on the Turkish intervention in Afrin, which was accomplished by means of militia units linked to Turkey. But I don't describe the details of the ensuing battles or the destruction of bridges and buildings. Rather, I focus on how this devastation pursued the lives and beings of an adolescent boy and his small family, the unfortunate victims of disastrous circumstances. The child who grows up under a constant hail of bombings bears no resemblance to the child who grows up beneath a safe, sheltering roof. The psychological impact does not fade away when the fighting and killing end. No, the impact may well accompany that child all their life, from chronic anxiety to post-traumatic stress disorder, from recurring nightmares to the difficulties of integrating into society and communicating with others. This heavy psychological burden becomes especially unshakable when there is an absence of support and when expert psychological care is not available. In my novel, I try to open a window onto this obscured world to tell the stories that find no place in news broadcasts. These are the stories of children who have grown up too early, whose personalities and imaginations the war has forged. Children whose future lives have been changed forever by the ongoing fighting. The novel is not a work of on-the-ground documentation, but rather an attempt to comprehend what is incomprehensible, to give a voice to those who have no voice. I have been in direct contact with children whose life conditions and experiences have closely resembled those of my main character. Indeed, members of my own family have endured what young Kamiran endures. So the novel is not purely a work of the imagination. It's the outcome of closeness to these young people, a witness to a painful and continuing reality. Now this novel has been translated into English, and here we are discussing it at an academic institution with global reach. I feel it is crucial to transmit these stories out into the world, not as passing transitory images, but as complete narratives, with all of the pain, complexity, and humanity that they embody. I'm glad to be able to express, thank you, my deep gratitude to translator Marilyn Booth. She has not simply exchanged words in one language for those of another, but has discerned the essence of the text and its human depths, imparting it to the Anglophone reader in an authentic and affecting manner. It means a lot to me to hear you say that. I hope that this sensitive translation will bring this novel to a wider audience, preserving its tonality and its internal voice, even as it crosses a major cultural and linguistic space of difference. War is not simply a matter of political or military conflict. Wars are human catastrophes that strike deep. Wars tear apart and restructure societies completely. And war's destruction begins with the society's most fragile links, children. And that's where the text I had ended. And then Jean spoke a little bit about also spreading hope, thinking ahead, and trying to ask the most important questions that we need to ask in today's world. So now I thought I would just say a few words, maybe to give you a little bit more specificity about what happened, the novel itself, because then we're going to read a couple of passages, and also just to talk briefly about translating it and the challenges. It's been a great honor as well as a challenge to translate this novel and to see it come out, and I too am extremely grateful to the careful work of Dar Arab, to Nasser Bedri and Ali Benjini, and I also want to thank Marcia Links Quayle for her excellent conscientious and light touch line editing. I also would just say, I would note, you know, they mentioned we have Arabic copies as well, and I thought it was wonderful that you managed to republish the Arabic along with publishing the English. I mean, that's just a huge service. Yeah, I mean, it's just great, with the same brilliant cover, so it's nice. So when I read this novel, it gripped me immediately. I first met John at the Dubai Literary Festival. This was, you know, we all sort of date things sort of before COVID, during COVID, and after COVID, right? Well, this was the last event I went to before COVID. I'm sort of amazed that we didn't all get ill, but we didn't. I mean, we had a great time, but that was late February. And we had these wonderful conversations. We just talked and talked, and I went away with a couple of Jean's books. And I read Mamadou Emin, and I was just really blown away. And since then, I've read several more of his novels, and the versatility, the remarkable depth and language of his novels is just is really wonderful, and I would love to translate more. He's a meticulous stylist, and you know, for a translator, this is like a gift. So, you know, this writer is so wonderful. It just makes it makes the job more demanding in some ways, but basically much more kind of much in a way easier and more rewarding. I have been translating for a very long time, and I'm very fortunate that some of the novels I've translated are ones that, you know, I've read them in Arabic, and I've immediately thought, not only this novel has to be translated, but I have to translate it. I don't want anyone else to do this. So So this was one of the novels that I felt that way about. It's not necessarily something I recommend to anybody, because you do it then without a publisher, you do it without any money, you just kind of do it because you think it just has to be done. But luckily, it usually works out. So so I'm very, very happy about that. I'm just going to read in terms of the setting and characters, just so I don't sort of go off program. So in early 2019, I hope I have the history right here, the Turkish army and supporting military groups attacked the Afrin region of Syria, whose inhabitants are mostly Kurds. The army occupied the region and people fled. Safe Corridor focuses on the ensuing violence and occupation of Afrin, and it echoes an earlier novel that Jen wrote. In English translation, the title would be A Green Bus Leaves Aleppo. And that narrates more or less the same story, but from another character's perspective, an adult character. And I think this is a very significant point to keep in mind. So the central character and mostly the narrator of Safe Corridor, Kemeran, is a young teenager. His father was captured by ISIS in Manbij, where they lived, and then his five-year-old sister is killed by a bomb. These traumatic events leave his mother, who is a language and literature professor, literally unable to speak. Kemeran tells of the family's life in Manbij, Aleppo, and Afrin, the tragedies he witnesses, his stark coming of age politically and sexually, and the green bicycle that he loves and that gave him a measure of freedom and mobility. Now, his immediate listener, and you'll see this in the passage that I'm going to read, is a piece of commercial chalk, just the kind of chalk that you would write with in a classroom, taken from his school, which he treasures and protects as his friend when perhaps no one else is listening. And it's significant because chalk is a writing implement, and yet the voicelessness of these children is one of the themes of the novel. So the novel begins with an image that's both surrealistic and material. In his family's tent in the refugee camp, which is where this family ends up, Kemeran himself turns into a lump of chalk. Is it a disease, a state of mind, a response to the horror in which he's existing? Again, chalk is an implement of writing and of memory and learning, but here it's also fragility, melting, literally. It cannot survive, just as childhood, as a time in life that ought to be loving, protected, warm, and enriching. Childhood also cannot survive. As Jen has said, this novel is about the victims of war who are so often overlooked in war reportage of any kind, including even fictional, even novels, the children. I think it's significant, as I suggested earlier, that here he's re-narrating a story that he had already told, in a sense, and this highlights the imperative to consider children's perspectives, a sort of horizontal view of war and its victims, rather than that told from the perspective of adults, even adult victims. So Kamo recounts how his family fled Manbij for the grandparents' home in Aleppo, but Aleppo is a war zone, and so the family leaves for their uncle's house, but there's no safety there. With the Turkish offensive, they find themselves in a refugee camp with thousands of others. The safe corridor that the Turkish army trumpeted to civilians is not safe at all. It's never sheltered as a corridor. So the novel begins in irony and continues in irony and tragedy. And about translating it, I mean, obviously every literary translation poses its own challenges because it has its own aesthetic presence, which the translator hears and feels and lives, in a sense, and is responsible to. And there are many levels to the responsibility that a translator holds, responsibility both to the original text and to the new readership that one is hoping to reach. Translators are creative writers. We partner with the first writer of the text in producing a new work. It's also a responsibility, though, because the translator, as a reader of the text, is interpreting it. So this translation is my interpretation, my reading of the text. Somebody else might change, or you know, no two translators would translate the same work exactly alike. Now, for me, the biggest challenge in the novel is the narrative voice. Cameron's voice frames the narrative, and he's a feisty, growing young teenager who, by his own admission, is a garrulous, unstoppable chatterer in a tragic context where sometimes speech is impossible. He's precocious, he can be a bit obnoxious, he's full of life, he's assertive, and he's also terrified. Words are in his blood. Words are how he tries to deal with the unspeakable dailiness of living inside a war. So I had to think a lot about how Camo would speak in English. He hears and he reproduces a lot of adult language. He picks up terms such as nocturnal incontinence, which is important in the novel. But in the end, he's still a kid. He's a kid who's completely wounded inside. He's devastated by his father's disappearance, his mother's grief, the tragic death of his little sister. He has a sense of responsibility towards them, and that's weighing on him. I think part of what makes the novel so forceful and so emotionally gripping is that it enacts this imbalance between a child's consciousness and sense of play on the one hand and the awfulness of what he has to encounter and process, and how he tries to express all of that, but also tries to avoid it. And his voice, he can be rude at times, but he's also conscious of what the limits are. So I had to think about how to get this very complex, wounded, precocious voice across, and you know, only readers can assess whether or not I was successful. Sometimes it was appropriate to use a more formal, elevated language, because that's the way he's speaking. But then other times, you know, he's a kid, he likes doing kid things. He uses a lot of profanity because he listens to the adults around him, but there's a question of like, how rude should I make his language? You know, he uses disrespectful language, but it's from a position of semi-innocence. So it's again, a tricky kind of thing. I mean, he careens between the everydayness of family relationships, the painful movements of internally displaced populations, and the recognition of what war means. So I spent a lot of time trying to get his voice right, and in the process, I became very fond of this tragic young character. That's another hazard of translating. You really start kind of identifying with some of the characters. And, you know, the novel, as I suggested, operates on levels of irony. The title, of course, Safe Corridor, sets up that irony. I have to say I'm also grateful to Jean for choosing a title that is so easily and beautifully translated into English. I've suffered, been tormented in many novels by the impossibility of using a sort of literal translation of the title. And then as a translator, you get criticized for that, you know. Anyway, the title is really perfect, and it expresses the kind of tension that is woven into the Arabic. And it's perfect, strong in Arabic, and equally powerful in English. Thank you. So now we're going to do brief readings. Mm-hmm. And I guess the usual thing would be for the Arabic to be read first, but because we're reading different sections, and I'm reading from early in the novel, and Jean is reading from the end, we decided, didn't we, that I should read first? What do you think?
You can.
All right.
You can read
first. Okay, let me just. And it's kind of, actually, I didn't think about this, but it might kind of repeat some of what I said, but I think it gives you a sense of this voice. This is the first chapter that Cameron actually narrates, and it's called Allow Me to Make Introductions. My name is Cameron, but you can just call me Cameron. In fact, you ought to say it like that because it's more accurate. In Kurdish, it means the one who's blessed with luck. My mother used to be an Arabic teacher, Leila Arizadeh. And my father, the surgeon, Dr. Farhad, he was kidnapped by Daesh a few years ago when we were still living in Manbij. I don't think you know me very well, do you? He's addressing this piece of chalk that he's stolen. No, even though you've lived with me for 2 years now. I haven't written very many sentences with you in my hand, not many at all, I'm afraid. Just a couple of shambolic slogans, like, for instance, long live the revolution, or a saying like, Ejesh Hur. Allah Yahmi, God protect the free army. That's what I used to recite over and over, along with my schoolmates at primary school in Manbij before Dash came to town. But I don't remember using you to write, for instance, "The people want the fall of the regime." That was the sentence we kept on repeating back then when we were walking alongside the adults in their demonstrations. Or there was the other one, "Your head will be eaten away." And you don't even need to say the rest of it. "Your head will be eaten away, and that will make you as short and squash as my little brother's penis. He hasn't been circumcised yet, my little brother." I stole you one day. It was sometime in the autumn. I was at school, and I stole you. I thought you were so elegant. Slim, shiny, not like the other pieces of chalk, the cheap ones that came in white boxes with Directorate of Education of Aleppo stamped on them. Those government chalks were fat and stubby, and whenever you tried to write with them, they made a cloud of dust. The lines they made when you wrote with them were faint. You'd try to write out a word, and one letter would appear clearly enough, but then you could barely see any of the others. The chalk mutilated the word you were trying to write. One of our teachers, he was taken by Dash later on, despised the chalk. He was so disgusted by that government chalk that he used to shout curses at it. One day he was writing something on the board with a piece of that chalk when suddenly he threw it out the window. He said to us, coughing, "A revolution has started. Things have changed in this country, but the chalk has stayed the same. You have to start a revolution now, one that's going to bring down this god-awful chalk. Changing this chalk will certainly mean changing the regime, which can't for the life of it produce sound chalk that doesn't kill people off. The people want the fall of the chalk." Now repeat after me, "The people want the fall of the chalk." We shouted this sentence until the chairs in the classroom were vibrating, and all of us, all the pupils in the room, collapsed into laughter. The teacher slapped his hand against the table and ordered us to quiet down. Laughter, yes, but it was a true disaster whenever the teacher ordered us to erase the chalkboard or when he wiped it clean himself. That white dust filled the whole classroom. We always had to throw the windows wide open. The white chalk dust settled stubbornly on the teacher's hair and got into his eyebrows and mustache. He didn't look like a teacher anymore. He looked more like the town miller. He was always trying to brush the dust off his work clothes and shake it from his hair. That's exactly what was going on, my dear pretty chalk, my elegant chalk. That's what the teacher's chalk was like, the chalk the government makes in its factories. But you, my chalk, you came from somewhere else, somewhere outside the country. You were just lying there one day. That was the day I stole you. I'm just going to skip down a little bit. But then after I took you and put you in my pocket, you changed. You became just a plain little piece of something tossed into a corner of my room, which overlooked the main street in Manbij. Just a little piece of something that no one would think twice about, except for me. Like as if you were saying, "Boy, hey there, if you don't mean to write anything, why did you bring me home like this? Come on, pick me up, write something. What are you gonna write? Just do it." I think I'll stop.
أنا سأقرأ المقطع الأخير من الرواية. هيا يا كامو اتبعني. تكرر الصوت العذب يأمرني. عرفته، كان ذلك صوت أبي، أبي الذي تخيلت قبل لحظات أنه يخرج من الصورة. رددت عليه بيأس دون أن أراه. ليست لي قدمان يا أبي، لا أستطيع الهروب، أنا في محنة. السيل عكازك يا ولدي، اتكئ على السيل. وقبل أن أجيب عليه جرفتني المياه الهادرة. طفت عليها في البداية، صرت أتقلب وأدور، أرتطم ببعض الأخشاب والأشياء الأخرى الطافية والآلاف من أغصان الزيتون المتقصفة التي يجرفها السيل الغاضب. أختفي تحت الماء لأطفو ثانية وأرتطم بأشياء جديدة نهبها السيل من خيام النازحين. لا أدري أين اختفت أمي وأبي وأخي وخالي. استغربت أنهم تركوني ولم يأبهوا بمصيري. لم أبه أنا أيضا بمصيرهم. شغلتني نفسي والأمور العجيبة التي كانت تحدث لي في تلك الساعة عن التفكير فيهم. بقيت أطوف وأتقلب، أغوص أحيانا، أغوص حينا لأظهر ثانية، ثم أغوص ثم أطفو. كان منظر أغصان الزيتون الطافية فوق مياه السيل المتدفق جميلا على مد البصر. كانت الأغصان الطافية تتصادم وتتقلب. تمنيت أن أقترب من غصن زيتون يؤنسني في وحدتي. مرة أخرى هب علي صوت أبي العذب الهادئ. جرف للسيل بعيدا عن المخيم. شعرت بنفسي أذوب في الماء في المياه. أنا مخلوق كلسي، والكلس ينحل في الماء بسرعة. أنا الآن قطعة طباشور تجرفها السيول. سأذوب إذن، لقد اقتربت النهاية. فكرت في نهايتي. شعرت أنني أفقد أجزاء كبيرة من جسمي. لن ينقذني أحد. أنا وحيد في هذه المحنة، وحيد تماما. ضعفت كثيرا بعد أن جرفتني السيول كيلومترات عديدة. صرت نحيلا جدا وفقدت قسما كبيرا من حجمي. لقد ابتعدت كثيرا عن المخيم وسرت مع السيل دون مقاومة. العودة مستحيلة والنجاة مستحيلة. الذي ليس مستحيلا هو الذوبان البطيء في مياه السيل، أي الموت فقط. إنها النهاية إذن. النهاية خرافة يا ولدي، ليست هناك نهايات. إنه أمر نسبي، فالحروب لا ولن تنتهي، الموت كذلك، المجازر، شرور بني البشر، وهذه الدورة التي ليست لها بداية. أقصد الوجود. أتعتقد أن الوجود سينتهي؟ لا أبدا، لا فناء، لا فناء. كيف يا أبي؟ يعني أن الوجود دائرة، كل ما فيه دائري، الزمان والحركة والمكان والمادة. ليست المادة سوى دائرة بدءا من الذرة حتى الكون اللامحدود، حلقات ضمنها حلقات. لذلك لا تؤمن بشيء اسمه نهاية ولا بالفناء. لم أفهم حديث أبي الغامض. كنت أذوب، أفنى، كنت أتلاشى كليا. فكيف يزعم أبي أنه لا فناء؟ ما هو الفناء إن لم يكن ذوبان قطعة طباشير في ماء السيل؟ إنني أفنى، وهذه هي الحقيقة الوحيدة التي أعيشها الآن يا أبي. إنها نهايتي، نهاية حكايتي.
Thank you very much also for this beautiful but also very moving reading and very sad ending. Thank you also to you, Marilyn, for your reading and presentation. I think we now have a little bit of time for questions from the audience. Now, I am in the privileged position of chairing this, so I will have probably the privilege of asking a first question, a more general one that is actually addressed to all our panelists today, but above all to Jan. And this is a question in a certain way related a little bit to a discussion I had with some of my students this morning in my Turkish literature class. And that had to do with the distinction that can be made between Turkish literature and literature in Turkish. Mm-hmm. Literature that would be produced by people in the Turkish language, but people, writers, poets, who do not self-identify as Turkish. I think there is a possibility to have a very similar debate in an Arabic context as well. In Turkey, it's very controversial. You have people on all sides of the political scene who have different opinions on this. I was wondering whether when you write in Arabic, you consider the works you produce, you would categorize them as Arabic literature or literature in Arabic. And it's also a question I have for you, Marilyn, as a translator, how you would stand on this debate, and of course to you both as well. So that would be one question, and then afterwards I'll have a question about Kurdish literature as well. But
أنا فهمت السؤال.
ممتاز. هذا حديث تحدثنا سابقاً يعني أنا وياك.
السؤال فهمته. بس أرد بالعربي. أنا أعتبر دائما اللغة العربية لغتي الأم الثانية. عندي لغتا أم هي الكردية والعربية. وأكتب بهما كليهما يعني بالطريقة نفسها مع يعني تبدل المشاعر حين أكتب بالكردية أو بالعربية. هذا أمر يخص الروح الإنسانية، يعني أنا كردي، ولدت لأب وأم كرديين، وعندما أكتب بالكردية أشعر بأنني يعني أشعر ربما شعور لا يمكن وصفه. في اللغة العربية نعم أنا أشعر أنني أكتب أدبا في العربية وليس ربما أدبا عربيا، لأن كثير من رواياتي ومواضيعي تتحدث عن البيئة الكردية، عن التاريخ الكردي، وعن الشخصيات الكردية، وهذا ربما يعني لا يدخل ضمن باب الأدب العربي، إنما اللغة العربية والمادة الجسم كردي.
Well, I think, and I didn't take complete notes, but Jean is saying that both Kurdish and Arabic, and since our mother tongues for him, but Arabic is sort of a second mother tongue, and so it's different writing in the two languages. And they're in writing in Kurdish, there's a certain just basic sense that this is your language, and mm-hmm. you know, this is you're writing it. And when you write in Arabic, you are writing about a Kurdish context, Kurdish characters, and so in response to Laurent's question, yeah, this is, you would consider this literature in Arabic rather than necessarily Arabic literature. Am I getting that right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's basically so. We sort of had a, I'm hoping that Ali is going to translate some of the
You translate exactly.
Yeah.
Okay, all right, good. So you wanted me to
Yes, I mean,
well?
Because you
yeah,
translate.
Yeah, I mean, that's, there's some very specific ways in which that came into this translation. I mean, I unfortunately don't know Kurdish, so I can't translate this novel with Kurdish in my head. But just on a very specific level, there's, for instance, the issue of place names. You know, do you translate them according to the Arabic or according to the Kurdish? And that's a political issue because the Syrian government, I'm not sure which year, but the Syrian government at a certain point tried to change all the Kurdish names to Arabic ones, right, of villages and so forth. And then they were changed back. And so, you know, here I am, I'm translating an Arabic novel. Should I follow the Arabic or should I change it? I mean, in the end, you also want it to be as familiar to, in general, to the English lot audience as you want. Just another example of that, I recently also translated a 19th century novel, which is, of course, an Arabic novel. And I would consider it part of Arabic literature, but it is set in Istanbul. The characters are Turkish and Ottoman Turkish. And so I faced this kind of issue of like, okay, do I use Turkish spellings, Turkish, sort of what would be an Ottoman transliteration,
mm-hmm.
or do I use Arabic, Lütfi or Lütfi, you know, that kind of thing. And in the end, I used the Arabic, but for certain institutions in Istanbul, I used an Ottoman transliteration. But these are issues because these are multilingual societies, and that's part of the world that these characters are living in, and that as a translator you want to convey.
Mm-hmm.
So.
May I add something here? That is a really very interesting question. To that point where I ask myself if someone born an Arab born in England is whatever he write is just an Arabic written in English. Now with all like the differences in the situations might be, I think any language is your way to express what you have in mind. So you use what you think is you are the best in it. Now you might, as Jan said, my Arabic is the second language, and I'm not sure to what extent, like, I think he got two first languages. Because to have a second language means
second mother language.
Yeah. But like again, you can have two times. Like you are, if you, you know, when it's second, that means you don't use it as much as. But however, like if what you think is the audience, and one, two, three, like of what you're writing, but then you don't think about the quality. You know, the quality of what you write. If you not, if you are not holding with the whole strength of what that language can give you and make you able to say whatever in your head in the best literary way you can do it, then you are writing an article and calling it a poem. That's not right. But if you are fully into this language, then nothing called first or second language. You can, like, that, for example, that guy who is, we translated from his novel.
Yeah.
Mm. No. Novel from France to Arabic.
Yeah, Latin, Venezuela. Yeah, from Venezuela, but he
He's from Venezuela. He won the two best, biggest prize in France, but he is originally from Venezuela. But he writes in French. Now, like, is it going and ask him, is you writing in French means like it's your like it's your French is like your second language? I think literature or literary or literature is literature. We take it, we take that book and what language is written, and we evaluate that literature. Is it literature? Is it like is it art? You know. It's like a musician, you know, from X part of the world playing another like part of music of that part of the world. And what is this music? Is that music is your X like part? Or is it, I don't know. It's very complicated, but I do understand from where it's come from. However, I think all like with, especially with Kurd or Kurdish, it's a bit different and a lot different. Someone who is born in Syria is totally different and like, you know, they know 100% like speak like Arabs, totally different than those who are born in Istanbul and they don't speak totally Arabic and they speak Turkish fully, you know, and or those whom being born in Iran and they speak, you know, Iranian. All these three characters, they all speak like Kurdish plus one language, either Iranian, Arabic, or some of them, of course, more than one.
Nasser, can I add something to what you're saying just really, really fast? I mean, this also with Arabic and certainly with other languages, this also comes into the question of dialects and, you know, because this is also, you're absolutely right, it's about art and expression. It's also political. And, you know, and the same goes with, I mean, I always struggle in novels when you've got dialects being used and the use of an Arabic dialect is itself, I mean, it's about what the writer wants to convey, but it also can be a political thing, especially if you've got different dialects in the same novel. But it's very, very difficult to handle when you're translating.
They've said enough.
I know I said I wanted to ask another question about Kurdish literature, but I know that I will be allowed to bother John later in the evening when most of you will be gone, and I'm a bit concerned about time. So I think I will open...